What's your picture of the good life? You know, if you kind of sit back and let your mind just spin, what image comes to bear in your mind when you think of just what would be really pleasant? Is it that lounge chair on the beach? You know, the one where you get to prop your feet up and have a cold glass of iced tea with a sliver of lemonade in it. It's a private beach, and its sand is as white as can be without a bit of litter on it. And you look out, and there's this wonderful clear blue ocean with the kind of mesmerizing sound of the waves hitting the shore. Not bad. Or is your image the one of sitting cozied up to a fireplace on a Colorado mountainside, perhaps, or up in the Canadian Rockies, where the fire is crackling and the hot chocolate is sweet and hot, and you're sitting on that nice bear rug, and as you glance out the window, there are these snow-capped, majestic mountains that just take your breath away. Yeah, not bad. For me, it's sitting in a golf cart on a elevated tee box, looking down at a hole, knowing that as soon as I pick out my club and swipe that ball, it's going to land within a couple of inches from the hole, and I can tap it in for birdie, and there's snow-capped mountains around me, and the birds are singing, and the breeze is gently wafting through the air. It's wonderful. But whatever your image, it probably includes peace internally that you feel, as well as a sense of peace externally. All is right in the world. It probably includes for you a sense of justice, that no evil is present to wipe out this really good image that you have, that nobody can come and take it from you. It has a sense of security, that there's nothing to worry about. I don't have to go back to work tomorrow. Everything's okay. And your image probably includes a sense of health. No pain, no aches, no worries about death and dying, because life is just good. Those are the very benefits of the kingdom. And wherever we are in life, that is what we long for. Oh, maybe not a lounge chair or a balcony, but we long for life that has those kinds of characteristics of health and justice and security and peace and tranquility. And we'll do almost anything to get it as soon as possible. In fact, our world desires the same thing. And our world employs all kinds of methods to achieve those kinds of benefits. They will step on each other and put each other down and clamor and compete in a world where it seems that there's only a limited amount of peace and prosperity and joy and health to go around. And you better get yours, because if you don't go after it, you don't have a chance. That is the world in which we live, and it pulls at us. And it's the opposite of how Jesus wants to pursue kingdom benefits. How does King Jesus want us to pursue kingdom benefits? How should we go about the process of pursuing the benefits that he has for us? Now, listen carefully to the question. I'm not asking, how do we get those benefits? This is not a question about how to gain something. It is a question about how to pursue it, how to orient life in a direction that moves toward those benefits. That is our question for the day. And we are going to discover in a text that we look at that the very disciples of Jesus are pursuing those same kinds of benefits. But they're doing it in a worldly way. And so they are people who are like us, wanting the good life that only the king can provide. And yet they have fallen into a trap of pursuing those benefits in a way that the king does not approve. So this morning we find out, first of all, how not to pursue those benefits, and then how we ought to pursue those benefits, and then a model in the person who shows us best how to do it. So what not to do, what to do, and then a look at our exemplar. Our text is Matthew chapter 20, and I invite you to turn there to see, first of all, how not to pursue kingdom benefits. Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to see it's not by climbing over others to get improved life for ourselves. We pursue kingdom benefits not by stepping on others for the benefit of ourselves. That's what the disciples were doing. They were stepping on others, or at least thinking about it. Matthew chapter 20, we are in verse 20. Notice what the disciples do as they try to pursue their kingdom benefits, and then how Jesus replies. We'll read through the first half of verse 26. Matthew 20:20 says like this, "Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, and kneeling down, asked a favor of him." So she is in a posture of worship and acknowledging him as king. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit on your right and the other on your left at the kingdom." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or at my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." Now, when the ten heard about this, the ten other disciples, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you." Stop there. What Jesus is telling his disciples and telling us is that we are not to pursue kingdom benefits by stepping over others to benefit ourselves. Look what the disciples are doing. And actually, on the one hand, it's kind of admirable until we begin to dig a little bit more deeply. For James and John and their mother Zebedee come to Jesus and ask for an acknowledgement that Jesus is king, and to say, "Hey, in your kingdom, could my sons have the highest positions next to you? We don't want to usurp your power, but we'd really like to have these privileged positions." Now, why would they ask that? Well, first of all, Jesus is now on his way into Jerusalem. He's headed there. And the anticipation is that he's about to enter Jerusalem and set things right and set up the kingdom. And the kingdom, they're right on the doorstep of having the kingdom of God with Jesus on the throne come to its fruition. And so the time is, it's coming. And if they get those positions, then in fact, everyone else would be able to serve them. And they really don't have to worry about people being powering over them or authoritative over them. Essentially, they can have the good life. And it's interesting the way they pursue it, because these two guys are probably cousins of Jesus. And then you've got their mother is an aunt, right? A sister to Mary. So they're likely working within a framework of a cultural system of, here's what you do for the family. We're all in this together, right? So, hey, Jesus, when you get to the throne, you treat your family right. And you let us occupy that high position with you. I mean, that's what you would do in a culturally acceptable way to honor the family. That's what you do to get to the top and get the benefits for yourself. Well, it'd be nice if the problem was confined to only James and John, these two sons of Zebedee. But in fact, we know that it's the whole group of disciples. Because when the rest of them hear, what do? They get angry. They're disturbed. Why do you suppose they're disturbed? Probably because they don't want to get stepped on. They don't want to get bypassed. They don't want to get lost in this game of kind of family one-upmanship. They want their places too. And Jesus knows exactly what they're thinking. So Jesus steps in and he gives them some correction. He talks to these corporate ladder climber types in order to set their thinking straight. And in a word, what he tells them is this: stop it. Stop it. Quit trying to pursue kingdom benefits by stepping on others so that you'll benefit yourself. Now, he says it in a couple of ways. First of all, he says in verse 22, I'm sure you saw it, you don't know what you're asking. This is like Jesus saying, you're just ignorant. Stop this. This is like the 16-year-old who comes to his father with his new driver's license and says, and he's never been out of Texas before, hey, Dad, can I have the car? I got a friend in Canada I want to go see. And the father goes, you have no idea what you're asking. You don't even know where Canada is. Jesus looks at these disciples and he says, hey, James and John, I know that you were with me at the Transfiguration. You're part of the inner three. I know that we're related. And one day they're going to be with him in Gethsemane. They are the close-knit part of the inner circle with friends with Jesus. But you don't know what you're asking. Stop it. They're ignorant. Ignorant of what it is that Jesus expects. And that becomes very clear in the verses that follow. Back to Matthew chapter 20. And we'll look at verse 23. In verse 22, can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? Can you suffer along with me? Because you don't understand that yet. Oh, we can, they say quite unrealistically. Very good, you will. But I cannot give you the positions you seek. That's up to the Father. They're ignorant of how the benefits of the kingdom are dispersed. They don't come by being earned. They don't come by being accomplished. They come by the gracious hand of a Father in heaven. So Jesus tells them, stop doing it this way. He has a similar message for the 10. Because when the 10 are gathered together, and he says to them, how it is they should not be like the Gentiles in this whole activity of seeking benefits for themselves. Look at verse 25. You know that the rulers of Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. What's Jesus saying? And then he said, not so with you. Stop it. The kingdom doesn't work this way. We don't work in a system whereby people step on each other to get to the top. Not in my kingdom. We don't work on a system of competition. Not in my kingdom. We don't work on a system of manipulation and family ties in order to get to the top and enjoy kingdom blessings, not in my kingdom. And you can imagine the disciples sitting there going, but this is how we live. Their whole culture was wrapped up in that. Achievements, clothing, inscriptions on statues, placement in the synagogue. Good old Jewish know-who to get them to the top. Not so. Now, it'd be easy for us to just get angry with the disciples and say, well, those guys are really off base. But I suggest to you that as the disciples are sucked into a cultural system of stepping on people in the process of pursuing benefits, so we are as well. Our culture pulls us in this direction, and our selfishness is quick to follow. Choose a career. You know, one that will get you the most benefit and the least with the least amount of effort, though it might put you in an industry that is filled with injustice and corruption. Live in a neighborhood that'll bring you peace and security, real kingdom benefits, and status, safety. But owning that house in that neighborhood may commit you to many obligations that will keep you from service of the King. Pursue that promotion at work, but it will likely mean that you'll have to neglect a family in the process. Store up investments to have an idyllic retirement, though it may keep you from being generous and helping others who need it so badly. It's a world system that basically says, well, you can't do things illegally in stepping on people. But we have our cultural processes, don't we, that applaud those who pursue kingdom benefits, even if it tramples people along the way. And Jesus says to us, stop it. That's the wrong way. But this text also gives to us the right way. The right way to pursue kingdom benefits. And Jesus tells his disciples and tells us, do it by sacrificing self to benefit others. By sacrificing self to benefit others. Rather than seeking benefit for self, by stepping on others, we are in fact going to sacrifice self to benefit others. Notice how he says it at the end of verse 26 and then on to verse 27. Back in the text. Not so with you. Instead, here's the contrast, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Must be your servant. Read it with your lip curled up in disgust. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. These are not pretty words. What Jesus says to his disciples is that they are to pursue kingdom benefits, but they are to do really what they're doing is by doing it by sacrificing themselves for the benefit of others. He says this in a couple of different ways. If you want to be great, if you want to be first in the kingdom, then what's he saying? I don't think the idea is if you want to be better than everybody else. I don't think this is an idea of comparison of one another. These are words that would basically give the idea if you want to be noticed by the King and prominent and one who's in line for kingdom blessings. One is moving in the right direction, then here's what you do. you take the position and the activity of being a slave. Even worse. I'm sorry, of being a servant. Even worse, being a slave. A term that was derogatory. Slaves. People whose lives were consumed with serving others for the benefit of others, not for themselves. They prepared the food and got the water and waited on the tables so they could watch others eat. And then they cleaned up the table. And if there were any leftovers, they were surely cold. Servants, they would clean the dirty sandals, wash the filthy feet, bathe the grungy kids before disposable diapers. They'd be sent out to the fields and they'd plow them by hand. They'd pick the rocks and stones, and if you've been to Israel, you know it's full of rocks and stones. They'd pull the weeds and pick the grain and winnow and thresh, but not for themselves, for the benefit of the landowner. They might sleep outside, perhaps without a pillow, no bed, and when they woke up, there would be no new clothes in their closet to put on. Slaves and servants, they'd feed the master's animals and water the animals and find an animal when it was lost and get blamed when the animal died so that the master would benefit. Slaves, looked down on, talked down on, considered less than a person, and no way out. No one desires this life. You don't go to your kids and say, I hope one day you aspire to be a slave or a servant. And Jesus says, be a servant, a slave, for the benefit of others. For the disciples, I think there could be no more graphic words. Really? With no benefit for us? Do not step on others to benefit self, but sacrifice self for the benefit of others. What does that look like in our day? We could probably think of lots of examples. Let's take a few spheres of life. How about at home? What does it look like to serve at home? It means parents sacrifice their own work for the sake of children. The work maybe they brought home from the office or the workplace to benefit somebody else. They may sacrifice their own joys, like a nice cup of tea in front of the TV, to the benefit of their kids. It could also mean that the kids sacrifice their lives for the benefit of parents, so that kids, as they get older, would give up a date or a trip to the movie in order to clean the kitchen or sweep out the garage or mow the lawn. Not for their benefit, but for the benefit of others. How about at work? A slave or a servant might take this posture as a manager who does the work of a subordinate so she can get home in time to be with her family. Or it might be the subordinate who does the work of the manager not because the manager demands it, but so that the manager will look better and that manager can go home and take care of personal business. How about in the neighborhood? Sacrificing a Saturday to to go mow the neighbor's lawn because she can't afford to have it done and she doesn't have her own mower. Or take care of that single mom's kids while she goes to the store. You'll miss the Saturday football game, but it's being a slave. And in church, here are the endless opportunities to sacrifice ourselves for the benefit of others. It's so good to watch what happens here on Sunday. We do well in this, and yet we can do even more. Think of it. To visit the elderly and the shut-ins, you'll lose time. There's not much in it for you. It's a sacrifice of your life for the benefit of others. But that's being a servant. And many of you have done that visiting my own parents, and I thank you. How about serving in Awana? Oh, every Tuesday night. Children's church. But I'd miss the. Sunday school. Yeah, I got to be here at 9:15. Yeah. A little sacrifice for the benefit of others. How about coming early to open up or set up the building or prepare the Lord's Supper elements or stay up late to close up and clean up and after a fellowship supper or fellowship lunch? Yeah. Servant. Sacrifice. How about giving up vacation time to serve with a missionary or help on a church project? Or attend a funeral and writing a card to grieve with someone who mourns, even though it's not for your benefit, it's for theirs. You see, life in the kingdom is a series of sacrifices. It is an ongoing lifestyle which says, I will give up, I will give up, I will give up for the benefit of others. Is there no end? No. No. When have I done enough? That's really not the question. The question is, are we doing better all the way along? Even in our major life decisions, joining with a group like Our Calling to spend a life ministering to homeless, heading for a foreign field, adopting an orphan. Huge life decisions that can set us on a trajectory of servanthood in pursuit of kingdom blessings. Sacrifice self to benefit others. And here's the best part. As Christ Himself has done. We do this as Christ Himself has done. Back to the text. What does he say? We're in verse 28. Just as the Son of Man did, not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life a ransom for many. What has Jesus done? He came to this earth with one major purpose. And he wraps it up in this phrase. Not to be served, but to be a slave, a servant. Not for his benefit, but for the benefit of many. He uses the word ransom. It's the idea of a payment to set something, a slave free. He says, my life became a payment that would buy out people from slavery to sin. And lest you think this is just a nice little kind of picture, poetic speech and metaphor, I want you to notice what Jesus said at the beginning of this text. Chapter 20, verse 17. Notice the model that Jesus has set up already. Now, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, verse 18, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And then the third day, he'll be raised to life. Jesus has set his course as the Son of Man to sacrifice himself completely for the benefit of others. You will have noted in verse 28 and then back again up here in verse 18 or so that Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. It's the exalted title. It's the title from the Old Testament where there would be one coming from heaven as the Son of Man, sent as the King upon the earth, who would deliver the reign of God on earth. He has the rightful authority, the rightful position to demand the allegiance of all, to command the submission of all. And he sets himself aside as Son of Man with his rightful claim to status so that he can serve others. And notice how he describes it. He is going to Jerusalem. He could have turned back to Galilee. He could have gone toward heaven. But he keeps going to Jerusalem. And he knows what will happen there. He knows that in Jerusalem, he could have struck down his enemies with a sword, with a word from his mouth, but he will not. He could have chosen a quicker, lesser painful way to die than this, but he will not. Instead, he will choose to go through betrayal by a friend and by his people, the Jews. He will choose to be condemned to death in the case of greatest injustice ever known to man, accused of blasphemy and insurrection, both false charges. He will choose to endure the mocking, where a robe will be placed on his shoulders and a crown of thorns on his head, and the soldiers will gather around him and hurl insults at him and spit upon him and say, "Prophesy, who hits you?" And they will laugh, for he will not defend himself. The text says he will go to Jerusalem and be flogged, receiving the painful beating of a whip that has at its tips the shards of glass and metal that cut the flesh with every crack. A punishment which by itself often brings death. And he will choose to endure crucifixion. Painful, slow, humiliating death. Oh, may God stimulate us with a vision of Jesus to want to sacrifice for others as he has sacrificed for us. My prayer is that we are captivated by him, that we stand in wonder of him who would endure that for us. We see him not giving in to cultural patterns of stepping on others for the benefit of himself. Rather, we see him sacrificing himself for the benefit of others. He is our model par excellence, our exemplar, our hero, the one whom we want to be like. And when we see him as our vision, we recognize that we are not pursuing the benefits of the kingdom. We're pursuing him. And as he waited 3 days for God to then honor him with exaltation, so we wait for God to give the position and the awards, the rewards, as God would by his own gracious and just hand. We do not pursue the benefits. We pursue him to be like him and sacrifice like him. How appropriate for us to turn and remember him in a reenactment of the Last Supper. To enjoy the Lord's Supper is to remember him, to remember this journey he took to the cross, to remember that night when he went before his people, his disciples, and he took off his outer garment and took the posture of a servant and washed their feet. And he served them the bread, and he served them the wine, so they would see self-sacrifice demonstrated. We turn now to the Lord's Supper, and I invite you, as we worship him, to remember this Jesus, who went to the cross for our benefit. I want us to sing a hymn together. It's called Beneath the Cross of Jesus. Many of you know it. If we could have the words on the screen, that'd be great. I'm going to show you the words, and Ruth will come, and we'll sing, and then we'll enjoy the Lord's Supper together. These words reflect, I think, demonstrate well the very sentiments that we've been expressing in this text. Beneath the cross of Jesus, here's an old word, I fain would take my stand. It's an old English hymn written back in the middle 1800s, and the word means I gladly, I eagerly, I willingly take my stand where? Beneath the cross of Jesus. Can I go back? The shadow of a mighty rock within a weary land, a home within the wilderness, a rest upon the way from the burning of the noontide heat and the burden of the day. Second verse also focuses on the cross. Upon the cross of Jesus, mine eye at times can see the very dying form of one who suffered there for me. And from my smitten heart with tears, two wonders I confess, the wonders of redeeming love and my unworthiness. And then this third stanza, it really is the response of this passage, that we would be like him. I take, O cross, thy shadow for my abiding place. I ask no other sunshine than the sunshine of his face. Content to let the world go by, to know no gain nor loss. Content to sacrifice myself for the sake of others. That's what we're singing. My sinful self, my only shame, my glory, all the cross.